This is Michael Shaw, and this is The Conversation. Thank you for being here. Great exchange with Anthony Pearson coming up in a second. Really edifying and thoughtful stuff. Anthony leads a very thoughtful design for living kind of life, so you're going to learn all about that and the way he makes his flares, which I think is particularly intriguing. So I just received last week a donation from a man in Lithuania, Roman. Thank you, Roman, very much again. If you would like to also be a contributor to the show, that would be very much appreciated. You can go to theconversationartistpodcast.podomatic.com, find a PayPal donate button there. And on any individual podcast page, you will find links to become a fan and like The Conversation on Facebook, to follow on Twitter, to send an email via Gmail, and so on. So I'm also very much open to angels, to have an angel support the show. That way we can keep the show free indefinitely. So if you are or know an angel who might be interested in supporting, please have them get in touch. Thank you in advance. And so now let's get to that great conversation with Anthony. Thank you again for being here, and I will talk to you soon. It's funny, your studio has this kind of balance or dichotomy of being very kind of austere on one hand, but also kind of cozy on another. Maybe it's because you have this, you know, beige and wood couch here at the end and the chair that goes with it, but you know what I mean? And it's also, I think, all the wood, too, that does it. But otherwise, it's pretty austere.
I mean, I think, like, the work, it can be analytical and cold and severe and brutal in a way, but there's also a warmth and the hand that's in the work is delicate, and I think that's how I want to feel. I want it to be clear and clean, and I don't want to say simplistic because it sounds pejorative, but you know.
Yeah.
But I want it to feel natural, like it just landed there, you know. The studio is supposed to be the same as the art, you know, and then it's an ideal for living, you know, how my wife and my kids live in our home, and the amount of art that's in our home, which is very little, and the surfaces of the home and the music and the books, and it's an ideal for living, you know. It's the artwork is the same.
Where did the ideal for living come from?
It has to do with solitude, you know, and yeah. Something kind of peaceful and something that I enjoy, you know, as an artist. Being an artist, I think it's supposed to be very selfish. You know, it's supposed to be, the artwork is for me. I made it for me. You know, if I made it to impress someone else, it wouldn't work. I made it because I like the way I feel when I sit with the art and I look at it. That kind of thing. I never understood the notion of the professional artist or the good artist or the kind of the artist that is behaves like in a way that's trying to placate something else or someone else or some other thing. That doesn't mean I'm a selfish person, you know. It's just the art, you know.
Well, when you say though that your kids are in this design for living, how are they thrown into it?
Well, my wife and I have a very specific focus on the rearing of our children, which is we have a media-free household and we don't use computers or television with the children. The children, they don't play with plastic toys and they don't play with toys that react to them. In other words, they don't press on a toy and it doesn't beep back at them.
Mm-hmm.
They were raised through a very interesting early childhood development philosophy called RAI. And it was founded by a woman named Magda Gerber, who had the responsibility of caring for an orphanage of children with a very, very small staff of people many years ago. So what they did is they taught the children to be self-stimulated, and they wouldn't stimulate the children. So a toy for a Rai parent is like a napkin, a block, you know. And now that our children are a little bit older, they're actually in Waldorf education, which is a non-academic institution, for lack of a better term. They don't teach to the young children. They don't teach reading, and they don't teach writing, and they don't teach arithmetic. You know, so a lot of these things are really seem extraordinary and out of place, but you know, there's an attitude that development can kind of take place in different ways, and there's different facets of intelligence and different facets of education. And you know, and in my own life, I did everything from my own proclivity. I'm a high school dropout, and I'm kind of a self-educated person. I never learned sculpture. I never learned painting. I never learned drawing.
So with your kids, though, how hard is it to keep that, to maintain that formula? Are there temptations all around them that you have to be cognizant of? You know, they can only hang out with certain friends and whatnot.
Well, this is very interesting. This is, as a boy, one of my best friends' parents were very... My parents didn't care what my brother and I did, and they allowed us to do whatever, basically. And my friend Paul Reynolds, his parents were very strict, and, you know, they were... you know, very healthy eaters, and they wouldn't watch television, and they wouldn't, you know, consequently, Paul fiended for sugar and fiended for media, you know, and consequently, as an adult, I don't care about those kind of things as much. So it makes me wonder what happens, you know, so you have to be careful not to push them to the point where they're where children are reactive. But currently, because of their ages, they don't really know much about that outside world. They're young. They're 6 and 3. So as they get a little bit older, there will be some introductions of things that Ramona and I will somehow mitigate for them and with them.
My cousins did Waldorf school in Germany.
Oh.
And because they lived there.
Yeah.
And so they were visiting... We were meeting, I should say, in sort of a midpoint, not where I, you know, where we live, but in the East Coast. And we were in this TGIF type of restaurant. And, you know, the TVs were on. And,
right.
You know, the older boy was just like, it was glue, exactly,
yeah.
For his eyes. So
yeah.
It should be an interesting process.
It is. It's interesting already.
Well, where did you and your wife's philosophy, I mean, you mentioned a little bit about yourself, but together, where did you sort of get the groundwork for this?
Well, my wife was a Waldorf student. She's from Marin County, and she was raised in a very particular way, and I was not. You know, I'm an LAUSD kid, and...
Where'd you grow up in LA?
I grew up right near the corner of Chautauqua and PCH. Right by the
Palisades.
Santa Monica Canyon, Palisades, yeah.
Nice area.
Very beautiful childhood. My father had a theatrical agency and represented actors, but a very particular kind of actor, one which was no longer viable in film and television. He would put them into regional theater. So he had a very peculiar niche business that he was very, very good at and very successful at. And
so there's this theme running through, at least with your father, in terms of you know, low to no media format.
My father was interested in radio and theater and was uninterested in film and television.
And your mom?
My mother is the daughter of a wildcat oil driller from East Texas, and she moved every 6 weeks as a girl, and is a self-made person who met my father in the 50s. My parents are much older than me. My father's deceased, but he was 55 when I was born, and my mother was 44 when I was born, so they're of a different era, you know. So.
Was she, just at that time, was that incredibly unusual, that birth age?
It was extremely unusual. Yeah, I was born in 69, and she was 44 years of age, and I was told by my fancy technical obstetrician that gave helped give birth to my two children that I had a 1 in 8 chance of being Downs. So there you go.
Fairly low odds, though.
Before amniocentesis,
right.
Before, you know,
sure,
all the advances. So.
Yeah. Where did you and your wife meet?
We met in photography class at CCAC 17 years ago. A long time ago. They call it CCA now.
But it was so CCAC. That was after UCLA for you?
That was before.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we met as undergrads. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you have a good experience there?
I had a great experience there. I love that place very much. The Oakland campus was where we were. And Larry Sultan was our teacher, amongst other people. And
was he already an Angeleno, or was he?
He was born here, mm-hmm. And his early work was done here and in San Francisco, and then his most famous series, Pictures from Home, was about his aging parents in the desert, when they were living out in the desert, and he was an incredible teacher. Ramona and I found out about his death by opening the New York Times. We were laying in bed and we read about it, couldn't believe it. He influenced my understanding of being an artist deeply. Larry, yeah.
So. Could you sort of boil it down maybe into
he was able to like poignantly touch on things through his art, you know, and that was very appealing to me.
He was the guy who did the porn set series,
and then he
too.
Did the pornography, yeah, right. The Valley, okay. He called
because that's
it.
The one I'm most familiar
with.
Yeah.
That was after our years at CCAC, he did that.
Right.
But, he was truly great. And there were many other great teachers. A guy named Chris Johnson was very equally as wonderful to us. And the whole craft thing that was going on, Viola Frey taught there with the big ceramic figures. And it was a really great time. As was UCLA, you know, in the late 90s, was very different, but
what drew
really
you to
incredible.
UCLA, do you think?
What drew me to UCLA is I got in my mind, I started doing photography when I was 22, and I got in my mind somehow that I loved art, and that I loved photography, and I never loved being a student, and I, you know... But I got so into this thing, and I applied to graduate school, and I didn't really understand what it was that artists did outside of the academy. I thought that artists got grants and taught, and that's kind of what they did in the 90s, early and mid-90s. It was not a time of... knowing much about career, you know?
Yeah.
And I didn't quite realize what that was, but, you know, I wanted to go to school. I wanted to go back to L.A. I think that's more than anything what it was. And I applied to CalArts Art Center in UCLA. And I came home, you know? That was 96, so...
Well, let's get back... to your wife and the fact that you guys met in photography and were both photographers, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
and you are now, you know, practicing this design for living.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you were, we'll also talk about your record selling business as well. Mm-hmm. But you guys, are you guys just two peas in a pod, and, you know, just a complete pair
kind
in a sense?
Of. Yeah.
Yeah.
For the longest time.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, are your personalities the same too, would you say?
not really.
Okay, tell me about that a little bit.
Well, she's very patient and very kind of, I'm irrational at times, and she's not an irrational person. She's a very kind of methodical, very calm person. But more than anything, we want the same things. You know, I think it's important for two people to want the same things.
Well, are you implying that you're impatient at times or hot at times?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people don't know.
Are you Italian?
About me. No. My father was a Jewish guy. My mother is like a mixed white lady, Southern Baptist, different.
Is that where the heat comes from, or do
they
come from both sides?
Strangely, they're both. Well, yeah. they my father was about as gruff of, you know, a Jewish business type person as you can imagine.
Like, see, because you're not that at all from what I'm getting.
I'm a business-like person, but as a means to an end, as a means to something.
But what you're telling me though is that this very sort of calm, relaxed, mellow
mm-hmm.
persona that I'm experiencing
mm-hmm.
and have been experiencing for the last hour
mm-hmm.
is radically overturned, depending on the scenario, in private. Behind closed doors?
Yeah. You would find it interesting, or it would make you laugh, maybe. It's something...
It's a funny
yeah.
picture, yes.
And people who have to deal with me and know me well, they've seen me come unglued.
It's so funny because I for some reason, I associate the name Anthony with, like, this very Italian, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure there are plenty of Jews named Anthony, but it's pretty rare.
Well, it's a whole thing. My father's last name was Pearlstone, and in the 1930s, he attempted to get a job in advertising coming out of Duke University, and he went to a person who placed people in employment, and they said, "You'll never work in advertising as a Jew, and we've got to do something about your name." And sure enough, it went P-E-A-R, drop the L, S, drop the T, O-N, drop the E. So he went from being Ben Irving Pearlstone to being Ben Pearson. And so I'm this guy who I identify very strongly culturally as a Jew. I feel like a Jew. I feel like I look like a Jew. I feel, and my mother's a Gentile, and but my name means nothing. It's a fake name, you know, and it's an English name, and there's a lot of black people named Anthony Pearson, I've noticed, and but it's a mixed name.
Well, you know, it's interesting that your dad did what a lot of, you know, actors and so on,
mm-hmm.
and business people presumably as well did, to assimilate, you know,
mm-hmm.
and to minimize the prejudice. And then you're talking about your name, how it means nothing. It's really interesting to me the way that artists tend to have these sort of elaborate names. You know, like if you
mm-hmm.
look through the galleries, you know, or you think about certain people, you know, it's either they were raised or born in a foreign country, or their parents were,
mm-hmm.
or they have hippie parents or what have you, and they have these very elaborate names. And it's kind of like you almost need to kind of have an elaborate name to kind of compete in a way, visibility wise. I mean,
I actually agree with you.
Yeah.
I shamefully enough do believe that it's true, and I think that if people have an awkward name, or a name that's cute, or a name that's, it's a little more unusual, and I think there's something. I feel fortunate that my name has seven characters in the first and last name, and the syllables of the name are somewhat cohesive and function in a certain way with a certain timbre, but I don't feel like my name. Even as a child, I never felt like that was my name. It's a very odd feeling.
Have you ever thought about changing it now?
No, I would never change my name. But my children carry my wife's last name.
What are your children's names?
My wife's name is Ramona Trent, and my children's names are Chantal Trent and Delphi Trent. Those are my children.
D-E-L-F-I-E?
D-E-L-P-H-I.
Okay.
Yeah.
Where does that come from?
Well, you have a very interesting show because it runs off the topic of art, but it comes back around. My oldest daughter was named after a woman who, she was named after the middle name of her best friend. And that middle name came from this strong-headed woman who created a scene amongst these people, some story about how she got out of a taxi cab because some man tried to be sexist. He was being sexist, you know. So my wife was attached to this friend for many years. We're going to see them Sunday. They've been very close friends from the age of 11. Leslie Chantal Dink. And consequently, her name came down from this woman. And then the second child, there was a whole list of names which Ramona and I did not agree on. And my daughter Chantal was very animate about this name, and the name has stuck. And it's also a name which you can, I call her Del. You can change the name. You know, as a boy, I was Tony. And like some people call me Tony, but very, very few.
Do they have to be close to you to call you Tony?
No, they just make the decision that they want to do that.
That's the same thing with me.
And I like that. Very few call you Mike, and you're usually known as
Mike. My family called me Mike growing up, and now I go by Michael. And then people who call me Mike, it's more like, oh, I can call you whatever I want. So in my case, I don't appreciate it.
You don't appreciate it?
No.
I appreciate it because I can see that the person who's doing it is trying. It's something to do with intimacy, you know what I mean? So it's like, how do we have intimacy with another person in the professional world? Well, we can gossip. We can talk shit about another person. There's different ways to get it, intimacy. But if they call me Tony, I see that it's a form of affection or something. And I like it. But I wouldn't introduce myself as that.
That's a very...
And I don't know why.
That's a generous way to frame it. I should probably...
Well,
take it as an endearment when people do that.
Not necessarily. You can take it as manipulative, too. You know?
Unfortunately, I think that's my default. So.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I don't want to worry you into thinking that we're not going to be talking about art.
No,
so
I like the...
Okay.
I prompted you by saying that it's all the same. You know? I mean, the records, to me, when I did the records, it's the same as the art.
Well, let's talk about that. So... We've established that you and your wife, you know, while she is more methodical and calm and, you know, and whatnot, you guys, you know, have a tremendous amount in common and you have the same goal, essentially what you said. So who came up with the idea for the record business, or was it much more of a sort of gentle arriving?
It was one of those things that happens in life where you're just, it was... chance, you know.
The first sort of arrangement?
It was, it happened with this guy named Tony Sherman, who was a high school friend and a great guy, and he knew about how to do this. And we were all, as a boy, I was into books and music, and I had a large collection of music by the time I had found out about this whole thing, you know, but...
What did you collect?
I started as, you know, a kid of the 70s, it was rock music, you know, and then as a kid of the early 80s, it was punk rock and goth and all this kind of stuff, and just, you know, I came of age in Los Angeles in, you know, the time when this was this big thing for young people, and it was very formative for me.
Did you go to shows?
And, oh, completely, completely immersed in it. I had fanzine, and I was in bands, and it was just my girlfriend at the time, we were totally into this thing, and it was like, but then I grew out of the punk rock phase, and I got eclectic by the time I was 17, maybe.
That was a short punk rock period.
Yeah, 13 to 14, 15 years of age, maybe, taking the bus around to shows at the Café de Grand in Hollywood and the RTD. You could take the 2 line to Hollywood, or you could take the 9 to Santa Monica, and we would go to Nana and these places and buy the different things, the t-shirts and the patches and the parkas and the, you know, it's just a thing. But learning records, I didn't know until Tony showed me, because he had a bedroom at his parents' house that he was selling. He was selling to the Japanese and the European shops and dealers, and he had what was truly esoteric items, you know.
So for lack of a better word, he trained you guys in the business?
He showed me the summer of 95, he showed me before I returned back to go to UCLA. He showed me all of these things, and I just, from that point on, even up at the last year of CCAC, I started digging around for music really intensely. And
were you separating your own collection from what you were going to sell, or was any of your collection fair game to sell?
Yeah, my records I would sell, and I would keep, and I would rotate, and I don't know. Today I have a small collection of maybe 1,500 records.
A modest collection.
Yeah, not small, but yeah, ordinary, right. You know. But
ordinary by record collecting standards.
Ordinary size, not ordinary records.
Sure.
Very unusual records.
Now, what is your range of eclecticism?
The records that I collect and enjoy and keep are generally, there's a fair amount of home pressed records that people recorded themselves for whatever reason, and they tend to be like, it's like you're looking into somebody's inner life, because they're so specific. They're made in a garage in Wichita in 1970, or they're made in a club in Baltimore in 1975, or they're made in a kid's bedroom in, you know, LA in 1980, and you can sense what it is. And it could be soul music, it could be rock music, there's no particular genre that necessarily appeals to me more than another. It's the recording that I get, and the tactility of the thing that I get so fascinated with. But another component of my record is a collection is ethnic field recordings, which is a whole other thing, which is more of an academic thing, and most of those things are made by people who are studying music. So
right.
It's not a commercial kind of music.
No, that's not, if you're selling that kind of, this is for your own collection.
Those things I collect.
So you wouldn't be selling that kind of stuff.
I do sell those kinds of things.
But you would have to find real academics.
I have to find those things if I were to have, but I never did, because those things are generally from Europe. They're generally very rare and unusual, and they're generally not easy to find. But I'm fortunate enough to have made some wonderful friends in records who are enthusiasts for this kind of stuff, and they allow me into that world and allow me to acquire things, you know, as they acquire things. And but I dealt in ordinary things, not the kind of things that I described to you that I collect.
Right.
I would find people in the music industry and in radio, and I would buy libraries of music, of classical music, rock music, jazz music, folk music, soul music.
And you were working with Japanese a lot, it sounded like.
In the early years, we would wholesale records to dealers and shops in Europe and Japan. And then what began to happen was the information age made it apparent to people which records were $4 and which ones were $40. And in order to be good at it, you had to have a range of material that you could work with. And just by my own curiosities, I became more informed about what was desirable in other genres, which never occurred to me. So I learned, you know, mono classical records from the 50s, or I learned psychedelic rock, or I learned... And by the end, because of the internet, we would mail order the items to the actual collectors. So in that 12-year period, it changed a lot, you know.
You know, what you're, this whole story and some of the other things as well, but I mean, particularly with your music, it seems to me, and maybe this will come up again with the art, but you strike me as such an autodidact, and I just wonder if that's something that is connected to the way you grew up and, you know, and what your dad did.
It
and
is.
So on. How do you characterize it?
My father was a very successful man, and he was very good at what he did, and he was a self-employed person, and strangely never told my brother and I what we should be and who we should be. And my parents did not care that I stopped going to school when I was 16 and 17, and didn't, you know, really tell me who to be or what to do.
What were you doing when you dropped out of high school?
I was doing a lot of drugs, and I was kind of a mess, to be honest with you. It was not totally to my advantage that, you know, I was this less than zero mid-80s Hollywood kid, you know. It was kind of to my disadvantage, you know. But
it sounds like you're kind of implying, though, that your parents had faith that you were going to come through it somehow.
My parents, you know, my mother was responsible for herself since she was 12, because her father, who was the person who was taking care of her and her two siblings and my grandmother, he died when she was 12. And I think she made her way in the world just in such an independent fashion that she's just a remarkable person from it. She's 88 now. She lives next door to us. And I see her every day. And, you know.
So you have a very unusually healthy mother-son relationship.
We do now. And we didn't always, you know. And but as a person becomes elderly, it's kind of a gift in some way, because they look to you to kind of take care of them, and it changes the dynamic, kind of. But my mother, you know, my parents were loving people. My father was a great, great guy. And I partially, you know, he died when I was 18, so I partially put him up on a pedestal and don't see the alcoholism and don't see, you know, his rage, and I don't see all those things that I know were such a big deal in his life. But part of the autodidact thing is, you know, when your father, men kind of have this thing they deal with their father, you know, and my father was gone. I had no ceiling. I had no limit. I had no expectation. Not that he put a lot of expectation on me to begin with, but by that time I was kind of on my own, you know, and figured it out, you know.
Do you, I can't help but ask this question, whether from time to time there's part of you that really yearns for your father to be able to see the work that you're making and what have you?
You know, actually, I feel my mother has seen my exhibitions that have happened here with Dave. But I think because the work is non-representational and because it's quiet, I think it can be confusing for people like my mother. And I think my father would be confused by it. And I think he would be happy for me that I can do this and that the work is collected and whatever. But I more or less feel embarrassed, actually. I would like more to be able to ask my father questions about how to do things and about his life for my own curiosity. But to show him my work, I think I would feel embarrassed, strange way.
That is strange.
It's often the feeling I get with parents at my children's school. Like, I don't want them to know what it is that I do because it's so... I find it to be peculiar from an outsider's perspective. I don't feel peculiar in making it, nor do I feel like a person who's interested in art like yourself or someone else. I don't feel peculiar around them, but for an ordinary West Side mom, I kind of drive by the school with my hand in front of my face a little bit, you know, because it's just so, and it's a dream. To be an artist is a dream. People don't know how to react.
There must be people in your life who are begging you or pleading with you or imploring you to, you know, be proud and to say, you know, and to sort of be a little... I don't think arrogance seems to mm-hmm. be in you, in your personality, but to just kind of be like, yeah, I'm an artist. This is what I do to these mm-hmm. West Side moms mm-hmm. and have them deal with it.
I think that I feel proud in a group show. I feel proud to put my work next to another artist's work, and I feel good about the work. I don't... A lot of the parents in the school are involved in, quote-unquote, the industry. I don't necessarily connect with the things they make, and I do feel... superior in the things that I make. I have those feelings as a person, you know, but more than that, I just feel kind of like I'm the weirdo, you know, which is okay because I kind of have always felt that way a little bit, you know, so, and I don't feel badly about it at all. I just feel kind of like, I feel esoteric.
Well, when you were, you say you've always felt like the weirdo, when you were, you know, the quote-unquote Hollywood kid, as you mm-hmm. put it, you know, doing the shows and whatnot, that to me sounds like you were very much part of a community or a scene. Is that not the case?
Yeah, well, it's very interesting that you ask this, because there was a moment, there was the period of time as a child who was... a child of early puberty, you know, someone who was 6'3" at the age of 12 or 13, but so bookish and weak that smaller bullies would, you know, attack, you know, and it took me a while to figure out how to deal with these things and whatever. But, you know, came the time of being the punk rock kids and the camaraderie with the other losers and freaks of the world. And, you know, I grew up in this very Polo Izod kind of reality, and that was not me.
Did you go to Palisades High?
I went to Palisades High. I went to Paul Revere Junior High School, Canyon School. But there came a time when, by the time I was 15, 16, suddenly, magically, we were kind of the cool kids. It kind of just worked. And it wasn't exactly Revenge of the Nerds, but it was just like, it was authenticity or something. Like, certain kids found authenticity through music and through art or something. And things got a lot better after that, you know? Yeah.
I wanted to go back also to this thread that ran through, again, the... you know, your dynamic with the mothers at the school, that there are, you know, a lot of industry mm-hmm. people and so on. The thread then goes back to with your kids being sort mm-hmm. of not in a non-media environment, mm-hmm. and then these other kids and their parents being in a hyper-media environment, presumably. Well, how is it that you're meeting with, or you're, I should say, in proximity to these industry people? Are they sending their kids to a school?
That's right.
So they're extreme
they
paradoxes.
They must know some things that we don't know, right? I mean, it's like you wonder what goes on inside the government, and they really do know that UFOs really exist. And when you see the people who make the television commercials and the movies and the shows, and you see that a lot of them choose to send their children into a school that does not support media, and as a child you cannot wear a shirt that says Transformers or says, you know, Bob the Builder or whatever it is these kids are into. Yeah, they do it, you know. So
before we finally make the transition to your work, what does your mom feel about your approach with the media, non-media, to your kids?
I think she just seems to think that I just have it together, I guess. She's very...
She trusts you.
Yeah. She thinks that parents today know more than parents did in the 70s. She thinks that. And I think she's right. She's right. You know? And my wife reads parenting books. Several dozen of them. They can be of different proclivities, different philosophies.
Is she an involved grandmother?
My mother is too old to really be an involved grandmother. But she's, like I said, she lives next door, so my children are involved with her. They kind of come to her and do nice things for her. And
right.
It's very good.
So we were talking earlier before we got on mic about your life, your period as a photographer. And it wasn't even as a commercial photographer, but yet it was a fine art photographer, but yet you made it clear right away that it was sort of the photography ghetto in a sense. So, and yet you have turned that experience and those tools and, you know, that form into something, you know, it's a very important part of your toolbox.
Yeah.
Now. So that's just kind of a lead in, but I think what would be really interesting to talk about is sort of the leap that you made transitioning from straight photographer, if you will, fine art photographer as it may be, to, you know, a multimedia photographer, sculptor, etc.
I had a relationship with representational photography for 15 years before I figured out that I wanted photography to be a gateway to both a non-representational practice and a drawing and painting and sculpture practice. And that happened by ultimately capitulating and saying to myself philosophically that a picture of the real world is infinitely less interesting than the real world. And I never could achieve the satisfaction in photographing the real world. And so I left it.
Were there certain models of... I imagine that there was a lot of work out there that you were maybe finding yourself really drawn to that was pushing in that direction too.
The thing that pushed me was the art, you know. Baldessari was hugely important to me. I saw a show of his at the Santa Barbara Museum of Art in 1986, and it was the first time that I saw what they call art and didn't know that something like that could be done. I didn't know that somebody could have big panels of photography that were you know, had these big circles and dots all over them, and they were assembled together in these huge things, and it expanded my mind, you know. But, you know, the painting, drawing, and sculpture thing, interdisciplinary practice thing, it really came out of having a deep involvement and friendship and with these peers, friends, artists who were not involved in photography. I had some that were involved in photography, but their interest in art and being a part of art waned. The ones who still loved art and really wanted to be in art, they were painters and sculptors. And I frankly couldn't believe that somebody could do something with their hands and express themselves in such a radical way. I was just completely blown away by, you know, this group of peers. Ramona was too, you know, coming out of photography, felt the same, you know. And they all loved us with the record thing, and were so amazed that we were adults, you know, that we were kind of like, we were going to have kids, and we had a house, and we had a business, and we were adults. And it was a great time, you know. That went on for years, you know. Just, and, you know, the friendships continue, you know. But I was a painter and a sculptor trapped in a photographer's body.
That's a really, I think that's a really extremely concise way of putting it. Yeah. And so I think people, and including myself, are interested to know, though, and I'm sure it's very organic and what have you, but what was the genesis for the sculpture photo, you know, pairing?
It was, frankly, it was the most pragmatic kind of earnest thing that I possibly could drum up, you know, because I didn't feel that I had the technical skill nor the confidence to execute what's known as hardcore sculpture, object on an axis in space that's generally bigger than you. And that was like the grand theme of sculpture, you know, to me at least.
Is that what you aspire to, though, on some level?
I think someday you'll see me learn to make works that are that. Yeah, but I'm working on a precedent, which is what you describe the sculptural range.
But that's what makes you unique, though.
What makes it unique,
right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's what's tied up in my question. I mean, why would you, when you found your own niche, why would you want to aspire to this, you know, sort of traditional sculptural paradigm?
I think the artist in flux is the most interesting artist, and the artist who's seeking something is the most interesting artist. I think the most interesting artist is generally the artist who is thinking about the fourth dimension, thinking about the trajectory of the artwork, and how building a language and having a practice that's essentially horizontal, you know, which means it's building out upon itself as opposed to vertical, which is refinement, refinement, refinement. I'm an artist who is refining and who will never abandon the sculptural arrangement or the flair or all the early things that I made. Will always, the strength of my work is in the combinations of things and how they relate. And each year I can add another thing, and it will somehow come off of what previously existed. But that trepidatious moment of making the small bronze work, which was a frontal object, which was pictorial in its nature, so carefully executed as to not come across as quote unquote sculpture, nor as tabletop sculpture, nor as something that you would see. It has a verso, there's no way of kind of seeing it as sculpture.
Verso, that's a great word, because you know, as bulbous and sensual, you know, as these objects, whether quite small or now getting to be quite large, they are, you know, particularly though with these bronzed pieces that you have, mm-hmm. it's like one has to wonder. So the back of that is basically a hollowed out reverse of that shape?
No, the back is flat.
Solid?
Flat.
Okay. Yeah. So is it solid bronze then in a lot of cases?
No.
It's hollow, but it's flattened out.
It's a casting. Yes, it's made from a mold, so it's a casting, and it is hollow. It's actually made in two parts and mm-hmm. stitched together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's not unlike photography. It's something that goes positive, negative, positive. It's something that's toned and coated the way that prints are often toned. They have a glazing over them.
Right.
It's made of often silver nitrate, you know, which is in concert with the silver gelatin. It's a relief in the sense, in the macro sense, just as the photographic print is a relief in the micro sense.
Speaking of which, sorry to interrupt here, but speaking of these materials,
right.
You have done these pieces that I seem to recall from the last show that had some very fancy sort of cobalt, one of them was, I seem to remember.
Cobalt.
Well, so what's the story with the different chemicals involved in the bronzes?
The story is that one could paint metal or one could put pigment in a chemical patina, but when you put the pure chemical onto that metal, and that metal is 700 degrees, and you spray that stuff on there with a torch, it bonds right into the material like it's a part of the material. So cobalt nitrate and silver nitrate are integral to the bronze work, and they evolve. It's a living material, so it evolves. It's a living thing, which appeals to me.
Where is the bronze, this foundry work taking place?
All of the foundry work takes place with a guy named Robert Winsky, who has a business called Artisans Bronze in Oxnard, California. And they like to put foundries in temperate climates. So he's near the beach, and this is so they don't have a lot of expansion and contraction of the shells and the molds and as they're making these things. And when you talk about an ideal for living, working with a man like Robert and driving PCH to be with him and to understand how he makes these things, knowing him has been one of the great relationships in my life. You know, he's truly an incredible person.
And this has just been like the last 5-6 years?
Exactly. Just over five years.
Did you get introduced through a peer?
Liz Kraft introduced me to Robert, yeah.
Yeah.
So Robert is a really incredible guy. He's a person who I work very closely with in order to get the work to behave in a certain way. So it's
very. So you have to hang out then while he's working on your pieces? Yeah.
I hang out.
Right.
And like a typical example would be like, I'll look at a casting and I'll take a marker and I'll circle and make lines and change this or this, that. And I'll look at a patina and we'll clear it and change a part of it and do it again, because it's the shadow play of these things and the way the light hits the surface and all of that. For the piece to activate, it's contingent on that kind of attention.
Right.
It's an elusive form, bronze. People think that, I don't know, there's a hierarchy. Some are better than others in the world of bronze. It's elusive because people think that, well, shit, it's a piece of metal, you know, or we'll just paint it. But it's a living material that if you heat the thing up extremely hot, cobalt will lay down blue-gray. If you heat it up hot but not piping hot, it'll lay down dark gray. If you heat it up a little colder, it'll lay down pitch black.
So here's the question. Presumably Robert has been generous with you in terms of educating you in the process. How much homework or what have you, being the autodidact that you are, did you come to the table with
when
you
None.
First? So he's like, I'd never made
a bronze, and I'd never made a sculpture. Never.
Well, it sounds like if you're going to make bronzes, hooking up with somebody like that's the way to go.
He's instrumental, and this guy Martin, who chases the work with a wheel, he finishes the sculptures. He is incredibly instrumental, and nobody knows this man or his name, but he sits in there and grinds for hours, but he's touching the work. Castings
are... You mean he's smoothing like the rough edges and whatnot?
And a casting is an interpretation of an object. It's not a replica.
Right.
So it's very interesting, but you know, I learn and understand and become directive just by asking questions. I just ask so many questions, you know.
I can relate.
Yeah.
So I want to pull back to this point that you mentioned, you made a little while ago before we started getting into the sculpture. About being the ideal, going back to the ideal for living, the ideal place for an artist to be is in this transitional phase. Is that essentially, you remember that?
Maybe I'm not putting it
no,
right.
No,
you are.
Okay.
I refer to it as influx.
Influx, thank you. So so this being in this ideal influx phase with your work. So the question that brought to mind for me, and I kind of agree with you. I mean, I especially, you know, in context of your work and thinking, you know, oh, here's this ideal of the sculpture in the round, you know, that's based on this tradition and monumentality and, you know, these kinds of traditions. And then here's this work that's modest, sculptural, but kind of inverso and, you know, and so on. And so thinking of it that way, I like, and generally, I mean, I like the idea, the paradigm of an artist being in flux rather not making this perfected thing, you know, over and over again, which a lot of artists certainly do. But the question it brings to mind is, how do you reconcile that influx element with the market, which you are doing?
I'm actually self-admittedly an artist who not every piece is as great as another given piece. And the earliest pieces, generally what happens is the earliest pieces of a body of work are charming and clunky and strange and a little off. And there's something appealing about that. And then the later versions of those pieces, as I've learned to refine and develop, are more gorgeous and beautiful and really put together. And there's something desirable about that. And I think that kind of seeing the artist in flux is a desire. That to me is the artist that I personally am into. Like the artists that I like are the artists that I can see. I can see it evolving. I can see it changing. I do it carefully. And I have a private practice of things that I develop that doesn't take place here. You know, things that people don't see. You know, a lot of artists do that, you know. I certainly don't release an artwork unless I feel that it's meaningful to me and that it actually was a key to getting somewhere else, or it was a resolved version of something prior. But I'm really coming at most people would be surprised at how I'm coming at art, because the look of the work and the way it feels to be with the work is one thing, and the great artists of my development were a whole other thing, you know, because I'm coming out of Helter Skelter. You know, I'm reacting
to
that.
Really is surprising.
Kelly. I'm like,
yeah,
I'm reacting to these things, you know.
Well, again, and that's really is surprising, I think, because my experience of the work outside of you has a large amount of mastery to it, you know. That's that's the way it feels, and it's that's not to say, oh, this is really disappointing because this stuff isn't in flux, you know. Mm-hmm. But there is a, you know, it's like these solar photographs or, you know, photo pieces are, you know, it's hard. I guess it's hard to make the connection to Helter Skelter. Maybe when you take them like that,
I can help you understand.
Okay, help
that.
Me.
You know, if you're an artist from LA who went to UCLA in the late 90s and who saw Helter Skelter, you know, as a 22-year-old person and truly understand, you know, that the great artists of, you know, that group were coming at it from a certain perspective, what you begin to realize is all of the students of those great artists, especially Mike Kelly, who was the most, I think he was probably the furthest reaching teacher for the group of people who I was with. It's very hard for the students of someone like Mike Kelly to in any way reconcile that we're interested in Mike Kelly, but we're not interested in everyone else's psychological life. And what Mike Kelly did in art was special at that time. And I remember going to Lace and going to Easy TV and going to these places and learning about Mike Kelly. But I couldn't be, and I wasn't his student, but I couldn't be the artist where I showed everything. I really hate the word conservative, but I wanted to be the antithesis.
Reactionary.
Not reactionary, which is also another bad word, but I have it in me. I have it in me, and I don't...
Well, it's reactionary within a context.
It's
not reactionary, period. Yeah.
But it is political, and it is personal. It is. So, you know, it's I wanted that restraint in the art, you know?
Sure.
So,
yeah.
And it was very not an LA thing to do.
Did you feel, you mentioned, you know, Baldessari earlier, and of course you're mentioning Kelly now, but did you feel a connection just work-wise to a New York aesthetic in any sense?
No. I identify myself with Los Angeles, and the artists I admired were... Mike Kelly, Baldessari, Charlie Ray, Chris Burden, Paul McCarthy. I'm like any other 43-year-old art kid from the 90s who is from LA, you know? I mean, it's like Mike Kelly's 2001 show at Patrick Painter was in this incredible event. It's like all of us were dying to go see Kelly's show, you know, at Patrick Painter. And then, you know, of course, consequently, this was the show with all these big rigs with sliding pictures on the, you know, and you see it kind of cycle through what's known as contemporary art, which can be dreadful, by the way. Contemporary art can be dreadful, you know, so it's like you're just trying to find your spot, you know, you're staking out
And that's why I mentioned the word niche before, you know?
Yeah.
So I think it's a little trickier than imagining yourself making sculpture in the future, but maybe you will and you'll figure out a way. Who knows?
I don't know either. I didn't think I would make the plaster thing, and I did, you know? And when you see it, it looks like my work. And so you don't quite know, but I am a quiet and slow artist.
Not that slow.
I'm actually a very productive person.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Yeah.
Well, what about this? Let's finally, because I think people are very curious, I would imagine, about the solar photos. And you were
mean
telling
the flares?
The flares. Excuse me.
Sure.
Tell us about how you arrived at that process.
I was trying to get away from representational photography I had mentioned, you know, and I just was photographing the sky, and I accidentally burned a hole in the curtain of my camera, and I began to use that light leak as a source for artwork.
So it was like the perfect accident.
It was a true accident, and it was the moment that I abandoned photography.
Quote unquote.
Quote unquote.
How does, if one wanted to create their own hole in their curtain, what would be the best way to go about doing that?
I did that by taking a 500 millimeter lens, which is one of these very long, you know, kind of almost like 18 inch in length lenses, and I pointed it at the sun. And it was an accident, but it burned a hole in the curtain of the shutter, like a magnifying glass.
Right.
So that was the, what they call in photography, the punctum, the part of the picture that catches your attention, the fold on your t-shirt, or, you know, the reflection in your eye. This was not the punctum in terms of the pictorial aspect. It was the literal punctum. It was the literal piercing of the apparatus.
Right. And then can you just, for people's edification, very cursorily describe how you then take that tool and make, you know, either a white or a black flare?
I digitally make the flares. So it comes from scanning the negative and taking...
What's on the negative, though?
The negative is a picture of the sky.
Okay.
But in the bottom center part of the negative, there's a tiny little prick of light.
And that becomes my photograph. Right.
That becomes my piece.
Got it.
So, and then by scanning that negative, which was done many years ago, we continue to use the same set of negatives. I format it. I make it radically vertical, usually, so it relates to the body and becomes an installation device. I print it in a way that positions the flare at the top, you know, so it kind of matches your face. I push the curves so it artifacts, it breaks apart, so it actually fails, and that's how you get this artifacting or banding, the concentric form. And I mount it to acrylic so it reflects and refuses you know to allow you to really truly view it pictorially.
That's a really important detail.
It's really very important, and it turns it into a non pictorial photograph. It's an abstraction, but it's also non pictorial.
It's another step in going against photography.
I consider it sculpture.
Sure.
So
that, and that's a pretty subtle yet large element in the whole. Yeah,
it's an element that's so intuitive to me that I forget to even describe it sometimes. You know.
Yeah.
But it's supposed to be a black mirror that you can see the other artwork in the room and that kind of thing as well. I've had people view them on more than one occasion trying to locate the image, trying to understand what it's a picture of. You know,
it sounds like the mothers of your parents' school, maybe. Well, Tony, this has been great. Do you feel like there's anything that we haven't covered? I think we're pretty good. Are you good?
There's always things we've never covered, but yeah. It's always, you know, to be continued. So.
Well said. Yeah. To be continued. Thank you so much for talking to me.
It's my pleasure.
Mine as well.
Thank you.
And we're out.